But what do we mean, first of all, by class alliance? The essential idea of a class alliance, as I'm going to use the phrase today, is an all-class, or what is sometimes called a popular front alliance, bringing together a broad spectrum of social classes, including sections of the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, in order to combat what is to be perceived to be a common enemy, or to advance a programme of social change thought to be for the general good of all. The idea of a class alliance, and why we're talking about it today, has been dominated mainstream left-wing politics for decades, going back to the 1930s. Back then, in the 30s, it was the idea of creating a broad democratic alliance against the fascist threat and war. But the idea is still alive today. You only have to look at the situation in American politics, where it's argued that everyone should drop all their differences for the purpose of getting together a broad alliance against the Bush administration, that there are no differences so significant that should get in the way of isolating and opposing the reactionary minority around the Bush regime. We also find it in the Middle East, something I'm going to be talking about in greater detail later, with the idea of all the Arab peoples coming together to drive out Israeli and American imperialism out of the Middle East. Or indeed, we also find it in Latin America. It's been a dominant idea, in fact, in Latin American politics, much the damage of the Latin American left for decades, and now encapsulated in with the around figures such as Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. The basic idea then of the class alliance is to bring together the popular forces, stretching all the way from the landless peasants to the sections of the capitalist class, to isolate what is perceived to be a particularly reactionary section of the ruling elite. Now, the question about class alliances first came up in the early 19th century. At that time, Europe was ruled by feudal or semi-feudal monarchies, where power was held almost exclusively, for the most part, outside Britain and to some extent France, by monarchies, by church, by the big landowners, who are all intertwined in their mutually reinforcing interests. And the idea of the popular alliance first arose in those circumstances. And you can see, understandably to some degree, because it seemed like a whole different layers of European society in the first half of the 19th century had a common interest in driving out the monarchies, the landlords, and the church from their stifling grip on European society. You could obviously see the emerging working class had an interest in getting rid of these parasites who basically bled them dry. You can see that peasants also had a similar kind of interest. The peasants, particularly the landless peasants, slaving for hours on end for the wealthy landlords and the church. But an argument could also be made that the bourgeoisie too, that is the emerging urban capitalist class based upon the ownership of industry and the banks, had an interest in getting rid of the feudal order as well. After all, the feudal order put a whole series of restrictions on their operations in terms of heavy taxes, dominating the most prosperous section of the economy by royal monopolies, by the huge lands holdings held by the church and the big landlords, that prevented the development of intensive agriculture, that held up the peasantry in backward agriculture rather than releasing them to form a labour force for the cities, and also in terms of preventing the emergence of a national market. These principalities basically jealously guarded their own terrain and imposed series of tolls and customs duties and so forth that prevented the development of a truly national market. So, if you are active in European politics in the 1820s or 30s or 40s, you might think, well, we've got a narrow layer of people, let's just say the top 2% of Austrian or Italian or German society, who were clearly part of the out-and-out reactionary camp. And then you had broad masses of people of different material interests who could surely all be gathered together to try and fight these people and drive them out. And you could simply say, well, don't the laws of arithmetic apply to social sciences? If you add together, let's just say, the working class comprising maybe 5 to 10% of the population, the peasantry comprising maybe 50 or 60% of the population, add together the middle classes and the bourgeoisie accounting for another 10% or 15%, surely that's better than just one class going out on its own and acting in its own interest. But as Marx and Engels, who had to confront this question, particularly in the 1840s, with a rising tide of mobilisation against the monarchies, against absolute rulers in Central Europe, they had to recognise the fact that social sciences don't, in fact, obey the laws of arithmetic. That, in fact, that precisely by accumulating more and more forces, each of which had their own contradictory interests, rather than adding to the sum, you actually subtracted. And so in fact, actually, the more you added these forces, potentially, actually, the weaker your total sum became. And this was proved in spades in 1848, when the bourgeoisie, who you would think perhaps superficially would have an interest in driving out the royal orders, actually betrayed the popular masses, the workers and the peasants, and for that matter, even the middle classes. Because the bourgeoisie had too many interests, had too much at stake with the old feudal order. They had bank loans, they had markets, and actually, as it turned out, the social connections, and I think Trotsky put it later, 1,001 threads connecting them with the old feudal order. And so the bourgeoisie, rather than playing out the role that Marx and Engels first expected, perhaps of what he put doing its job, in fact failed to do its damn job and actually betrayed the popular masses, supported the military crushing of the movements of the urban middle classes and to some extent the peasants and the plebeian masses in the cities as well. The bourgeoisie was tied by too many threads, as I said, with the old order. And they were well aware that with the rising working class, that by mobilising the mass of people against the old feudal order, the workers would not be satisfied with just getting rid of the king, but would want to do something about the day-to-day exploitation that they suffered as well at the hands of the capitalist class. In this situation, the bourgeoisie preferred to put up the limitations on its own power from the feudal order than risk the expropriation of all of their assets at the hands of the working class. The other things that Marx and Engels noted out of the 1848 revolutions was that the middle classes, the professional classes, the lawyers, the doctors, the shopkeepers, the small traders and so forth, were too vacillating. They were too caught, if you like, between the two great social classes, if you like, combination, if you like, perhaps the workers and the peasants, and the wealthy classes. The middle classes, shilly-shallied, they vacillated, lurching from reform to reaction from one month to the next. In a famous, but I think vastly underrated and underused document called the March Address, which was an address by Marx to the Communist League in 1850, Marx drew some of the threads of the 1848 revolutions together in terms of trying to draw some understanding about what the appropriate role for the working class should be in forthcoming revolutions. Marx said, not only did the bourgeoisie fail to do its damn job, but so too did the middle class. The working class therefore had to take the lead. The working class actually had to take the lead in the struggle for basic democracy, and in the process of taking the lead in the struggle for democracy, had to put forward its own working class demands for its own emancipation as well. Only by the working class taking the lead could feudal Europe be rid not just of could be rid of the feudal system, of the divine right of kings, of the power of the landlords, but by the same token, that struggle could grow into a revolution by the working class for its own specific class interests. This is not to say the working class had to do it on its own. It could draw behind it the peasantry, a petty bourgeois, small ownership class, behind it, but must in no circumstance sacrifice its own independent program for that of the peasantry. It could show the peasantry a lead. It could show the urban petty bourgeois, the traders, the small shopkeepers and so forth, a lead, and draw them behind it, but must in no circumstance subordinate its struggle to those of the other social classes. Now, this idea about the working class leadership in any class alliance for that matter, obviously excluding the bourgeoisie, but able to mobilise sections of the working class, middle class behind it, was actually like something of an orthodoxy by the late 19th century. The exception was the Russian Marxists under Plekhanov. In fact, a very important section of Russian Marxists, the Mensheviks, who basically felt that the specific conditions of Russia in the 1890s and 1900s were that Marx's March Address effectively didn't apply to them, that the bourgeoisie was late developing and therefore perhaps was a more potentially revolutionary class, that the working class was too small, that the autocracy was all too encompassing and too strong. The Mensheviks argued that the working class should indeed establish an alliance with the bourgeoisie under the leadership of the bourgeoisie, and the working class's job was to use their mass power to urge the bourgeoisie to carry through its historic duty of smashing up the power of the semi-feudal autocracy, the power of the Tsar's system and the landlords. Now, the upshot of this was that such was the keenness of the Mensheviks to subordinate the working class to the interests of the bourgeoisie, that when the actual crucial questions came in the course of 1917, the Mensheviks played a vital and desperately destructive role of trying to hitch the wagon of the working class to the programme of war, destitution and impoverishment, which is what the Provisional Government of 1917 offered them. Now, the Mensheviks basically developed the idea of the class alliance as, if you like, a specifically Russian phenomenon. It was left to Stalin in the 1930s to develop it as a program that was to apply for the working class across the board. And here you're going to differentiate between a program of an all-class alliance in the advanced West for the first next kind of third of my session, and then finally going to be looking at the class alliance as it's been applied to the colonial and semi-colonial world of the last 50 years or so. So the classic case of the class alliance in the advanced country is the case of the French Popular Front. The immediate circumstances of the French Popular Front of the 1930s was the war clouds looming above Europe. Stalin, who had emerged as the all-conquering leader, a new effective dictatorship within a bureaucratic dictatorship within the Soviet Union, wanted to forge alliances with the British and French governments in order to offset what they thought to be a mutual threat from Germany. This led to the signing of the Franco-Soviet Pact in May 1935, as a result of which, the French Communist Party was instructed to develop an electoral alliance, a Popular Front or a United People's Front, with not just the Socialist Party, that is, if you like, the Labour Party equivalent, but also the main party of the French capitalist class, misleadingly named the Radicals, who were by no means radical in any respect. Now, in order to justify this all-class alliance, which of course is a complete rewriting of Marxism, the French Communist Party, under the leadership of the Communist International, had to completely rewrite the basics of Marxism. Instead of classes being the dominant unit of struggle, the Comintern now argued that the major struggles in the world were between peace-loving and reactionary nations, led respectively by progressive capitalists and reactionary capitalists. The capitalist class, in other words, was now drawn up as being potentially an ally of the working class. And so the idea of the Popular Front in France was one of drawing together all the peace-loving forces of progressive France behind the banner of collective security in order to isolate the tiny minority of reactionaries who wanted war. And so, at the April 1936 election, when the Popular Front government was elected, the Communist Party campaigned on the basis of not, you know, forward to the working class, but a strong, happy and free France. Their watchword, as with the Mensheviks in 1917, was "Don't scare the horses. Restrain the struggle of the working class, lest they scare the capitalist class." Even to the point that the Communist Party, which despite having tens of thousands of members and hundreds of thousands of supporters around France, refused to take cabinet positions in the new government for fear that it might intimidate the capitalist class. The working class, however, had other ideas of what the Popular Front meant to them. For them, it meant a blow struck against the capitalist class. And they greeted the election of the Popular Front government with a strike wave, such to the point that 2 months after the election of the Popular Front government, I think in April 1936, hundreds of French workplaces were on strike or on occupation. 6 million French workers were on strike by June 1936, as a strike wave flooded across French industry. This did not embolden the Communist Party, but scarified and terrified them out of their skins. My God, we mustn't do anything to terrify the bourgeoisie. Our loyal French allies in a Popular Front government are going to take fright and think we mean seriously to steal their property. And so rather than encourage the struggle of the working class in France, the Communist Party did all that it could to hose it down. And declaring, it is necessary to know how to end the strike. So the main job of Marxists, communists, revolutionaries was how can we crush this working class insurrection? Now, eventually, the Popular Front went on to declare virtually every section of the French capitalist class to be progressive. Everyone basically for the out-and-out fascists. And the term the People's Front, or the Popular Front, was actually deemed even that term to be a bit too frightening, smacking too much of the lower orders. And the term was replaced before too long by the French Front, bringing together all the patriotic French bourgeoisie, together with the workers, together with the middle class. Now this, of course, turned out to be a disaster. disaster not just, of course, for the French working class whose struggles were sold short, but even a disaster, for that matter, for the French Communist Party, which basically served as a left cover for the government. But once the emergency of June 1936 and the strike wave was out of the picture, once the working class had been put back in the box, the bourgeoisie then turned on the Communist Party and drove them out of the government. And as it turned out, these mass ranks of the French bourgeoisie were patriotic and peace-loving and progressive when the German tanks rolled across the French border in June 1940, the French bourgeoisie welcomed them with open arms. Much rather German rule than ruled by the Bolshevik working class of France. The class alliances, therefore, the simple arithmetic of adding together the working class, the middle class, the French capitalist class, rather than augmenting the struggle by the left, actually disarmed them, as Marx predicted from the events of 1848. Now, the People's Front hasn't just been advanced in these kind of dramatic cases of class struggle in 1930s of Europe. We can actually also see hints of the broad democratic or class alliance in Australian history as well. In fact, it's been a staple of Australian left-wing politics for all the 20th century. Even before the Communist Party got off the blocks in the 1920s, a dominant theme of the Australian left was the idea of creating, or was what's called left populism. The idea of Australian people, the productive capital, small farmers, the small and middle-sized manufacturers, the shopkeepers and the workers, all rallying together against the parasites, the bankers, the speculators, the landlords, the squatters who lived off the labours of other sectors of the economy. And so we heard very popular in this time was theories of the money power if you like, a small minority of the capitalist class who was especially reactionary, who had to be driven out by the loyal, progressive Australian capitalist workers and middle class. Now, this idea was taken up by the Communist Party and barely adapted in the 1940s, 50s and 60s. The Communist Party sought to identify what it called the progressive national bourgeoisie. The enemy of the Australian working class was not the Australian capitalist class, but was a small element of it, the monopolists. The monopolists were the problem, not the Australian capitalist class, the wealthy small number of families, the BHPs and so forth of the world. And against them was arrayed the broad mass of the Australian people. And it wasn't just the monopolists, but it was also particularly the foreign monopolists, the multinational companies. And so we saw, if you read the literature from the 1950s and 60s, the Communist Party produced, they go out of their way to identify who are the monopolistic companies, what is their ownership, tracing the proportion of industry that's owned by the Americans in particular, and they said this is a specifically reactionary section of the capitalist class, and that Australian business, Australian workers, Australian middle class all had an interest in driving out American multinationals. Now, and later, of course, with a racist twist, Japanese multinationals. And this argument was taken to absurd lengths. The Communist Party in Australia sought to equate Australia with an underdeveloped third world country. They took the kind of analysis that they applied to the colonies, which I'm going to be talking about in a moment, and tried to apply it to Australia as well. Arguing that multinationals and the American states regarded Australia, this argument won't be unfamiliar to you, as being the 51st state, that it was a purely exploitative relationship, and Australians had to argue for the true national status of Australian independence. And this, of course, was taken to even more absurd lengths by the Communist Party of Australia Marxist-Leninist, otherwise known as the Maoists, who said that the main job of Australian workers would rally behind the flag of Australian independence. And so, kind of pretending that Australia hadn't completed a bourgeois democratic revolution, and that the main job was for all social classes of Australia, bar a tiny minority of Menzies lovers, who after all weren't true to the interests of Australia, but were merely, if you like, a screen for the interests of Wall Street and Tokyo, was to rally all the patriotic Australians against foreign domination. This also took the form more recently, I guess people might be familiar with the Buy Australian campaign. Again, the idea of a progressive section of Australian capitalist class against foreigners. And indeed, even you see shades of class alliance with the ACTU strategy in relation to work choices, where it's argued that there is a small minority of capitalists, you know, the big law firms, maybe some of the multinationals, maybe some of the monopolies, who are basically, you know, this neoliberal conspiratorial minority within the Australian capitalist class who have somehow seized control of Australian capitalist interests and have driven the agenda of work choices against the long-term interests of Australian capitalism, which is the kind of high road approach of better productivity, higher skills, training, infrastructure investment. And so the way the ACQ tries to pitch it is, and you know, when you hear Greg Conbay speak on some of these rallies, he says, I know many capitalists. He doesn't use the word capitalist. I know many employers. They hate and despise work choices. They understand it's no good for Australian capitalism. They use whatever, whether no good for the Australian economy. And so we have to, if you like, you know, join together with these people in the united front against the kind of the Howard crazies. What else is the argument about? It's just ideology all about. If it's not underlying that, the argument about a class alliance. This isn't a real interest for capitalist class work choices. It's just a small minority of them. Now, needless to say, this attempt by the Communist Party, or for that matter, the attempt by the ACT under work choices, to find what the Communist Party call a progressive national bourgeoisie, this progressive national bourgeoisie that was going to stand shoulder to shoulder with the ACTU against work choices, has turned out only to be a figment of the imagination of an earlier generation of Stalinists, and today the reformists, which is actually used to justify a weakening of the working class struggle in Australia. So once again, you see this, what Marx and Engels talked about in 1848, rather than supplementing the struggle of the working class by adding more and more social forces on an arithmetic basis, the more and more the working class reaches out in a kind of, if you like, equal at best, if not subordinate relationship to the rival social classes, the more it actually weakens the struggle in the, you know, to achieve the immediate object, which is the stopping of work choices or the improvement of workers' conditions. Now, so far I've talked about the class alliance, the broad democratic alliance, the people's front in the advanced Western world. I'm now going to talk a little bit about the use of these concepts in the struggle in the third world, the global south, the former colonies, and so forth. Because initially, so driven by the broader geostrategic interests of the Russian ruling class, which in the 1930s and 40s, which were to do a deal with Britain and France, that actually the communist parties in the colonies were totally disgusting. In India, for example, in 1942, when Gandhi launched his Quit India campaign, the Indian Communist Party denounced it and said that now was not the time to be undermining the progressive war, you know, the people's war against fascism. And likewise, the Vietnamese Communist Party in 1945 welcomed back the French army on the basis of the fact this was the French army marching under Marseillaise, the tricolour, you know, the broad, you know, patriotic, peace-loving French peoples to reoccupy Vietnam after the Japanese had been kicked out at the end of the Second World War. Now, of course, that phase is soon over. The Cold War comes into effect and Russia now becomes the enemy of Britain and France and now basically has an interest in carving up the former colonial empires of the British, the French, the Dutch, and the Portuguese, and so on. So the Communist Party in the colonies is now instructed to be part of the national struggle in these colonies to drive out the colonial powers. But, in a way, but in a self-limiting way, to mobilise the Communist Party supporters as part of the anti-colonial struggle, but not in such a way as to unleash the class chair of the working class, or for that matter, the peasants. The ambition of Stalin was not to see socialist revolutions in the colonies. The ambition of Stalin was to see the emergence of stable, national bourgeoisies. Whether they ruled under a communist flag or a capitalist flag was of no real interest to him. The crucial thing was they should not be under the behest of the British, the French, the Dutch, but should be sympathetic or non-aligned and open to trade deals and military relationships with the Soviet Union. So the job of the Communist Party in these countries then was to be part of the struggle to drive out the colonial powers, but to prevent the evolution of a social struggle for land and for liberty by the workers and the peasants. The job of the Communist Party then was to play out the class alliance, to identify the progressive national bourgeoisie of loyal, patriotic industrialists, bankers, landholders and so forth in the colonies, and link them together with the peasants, with the middle class and with the working class. Now this strategy was pursued not just in the open-out colonies, in Southeast Asia, in Africa and so forth, but even in countries which are nominally independent, but which were ruled, if you like, but which the Communist Party, which were actually independent. Here you might count Philippines, Indonesia after 1949, many areas of Latin America, they were not only independent but ruled by military dictatorships, often American aligned. And there, the attitude of the Communist Party, again, was that their rulers weren't really the Philippine bourgeoisie, weren't really the Indonesian bourgeoisie, weren't really the Argentinian bourgeoisie, but was a thin layer of the bourgeoisie. If you like, the imperialist lackeys, you know, they called them the comprador capitalists. That means it was just a section of the capitalist class which had sold their souls, which had betrayed their country for the sake of the US dollar and a good relationship with the White House and a bolt hole to go to in the event of a popular uprising. And so the job of the Communist Party was to be part of the National Democratic Revolution, and the object of the working class and the peasantry was to drive these quislings, these traitors, out of power to create a national people's government, which is basically the class alliance writ large, with the struggle for socialism put into the long-term future. Just as with France in 1936, if the Communist Party started demanding, as the Bolsheviks did in 1917, work for the workers, you know, bread for the workers, land for the peasants, then the landlords would turn askance against the Communist strategy of involving them in a broad popular front. The results of the strategy in the colonial world and in the semi-colonial world were disastrous. In cases where the Communist parties were weak, which was the case in many of the countries, the Communist parties in many of the colonies were no more than, if you like, at some level, a slightly westernised layer amongst middle-class professionals. This strategy turned the Communist parties in countries like Iran effectively into appendages or cheer squads of the nationalists, which either in some cases led to a complete dead end, as it did in Iran in 1953 or 4, when there was a royalist coup against the nationalist leader Mossadegh, or in other cases, the nationalist leaders did take power, as in the Baathists in the 1960s, Nasser in Egypt, the Baathists in Iraq in the 1960s, Nasser in Egypt in the 1950s, but these nationalist leaders, they understood the reality of class forces, they understand whose interests they represented. Fuck the National Front and the Progressive Front and the United, you know, broad peoples of the country, they slung the communists in jail or slaughtered them. And in other cases, when we see, in the case, for example, of the Philippines, the Communist Party spent a large, you know, many thousands of lives, the years and lives of its cadres, chasing after this non-existent progressive national bourgeoisie, which is somehow going to subordinate its class interests of hanging on to its power, its money, and as much of it as possible, and was going to throw in its lot for the working class and the peasantry. The Communist Party may have been successful in throwing sand in the eyes of some of the workers and peasants, but the bourgeoisie, unfortunately, as is always the case, were rather more class conscious of their interests and understood only too well that even despite all the limitations that the Communist Party announced for its preparedness to lead a struggle, that once the interests of the working class, once the appetite had been whetted for struggle, would go far beyond what the Communists were interested in and therefore drew well short of being involved in such a struggle. They may not have liked at times Marcos. They met in the Philippines, they may not have liked Suharto, they may have thought the Marcos family and the Suharto family were corrupt, were carving up all the best business deals for their mates, but you didn't see them out in the streets rioting, you didn't see them out encouraging their workers to go out and strike against the regime, because of course they understood their class interests and their bank balances only too well. Again, we see the subordination of the workers and the peasant struggle, for that matter, to the interests of the National Democratic Front, that they're chasing after a progressive bourgeoisie, rather than augmenting the struggles, again, tend to subtract from them. The final example I'm going to use is the situation in the Middle East today, where you see not so much Stalinist forces, but Islamist forces, which, if you like, have filled the vacuum which has been left by the devastation of the secular left in the Middle East as a result of the kind of dead-end strategies, the counterproductive strategies of the all-class alliance that was pursued through the 1950s and 60s and into the 1970s. Islamist organisations like Hamas and Hezbollah have filled that gap, but they too tend to use the politics of the all-class alliance, drawing together the Arab peoples, or the ulema, the Muslim community, against a common enemy. Whether the worker, the landless peasant, the urban unemployed, together with the merchant, the banker, the factory owner, around a program of freeing Palestine, smashing Israeli oppression, and driving out the American imperialists. Needless to say, this people's front, if you like, within an Islamist banner, and we have to be realistic, when you look at Hamas, its basic strategy is no different to that of the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1970s. It's basically a kind of secular nationalism with an Islamist veneer on top of it, mobilizing the Palestinian people from the banker, the expatriate multimillionaire making a fortune in the Gulf States, right the way down to the shanty town dweller, the most squalid conditions in the Gaza Strip, all to be brought together against Israeli oppression and American imperialism. But, as with France, as with Indonesia and the Philippines, this all-class alliance is incapable of really achieving its objective. It cannot smash imperialism. This is not the same as saying it cannot hurt imperialism. That cannot come win victories against imperialism. Clearly, the victory of Hezbollah against Israel last year is testament to that. So too is the fact that Islamist organizations can actually take power, as they did in Iran and Afghanistan in the 1970s and 1980s. But what it is a matter of saying is that the all-class alliance against, of all the Arabs or all the Muslims against the foreign force cannot drive out imperialism for good. And the reason why is that the weaknesses are exactly the same as the weaknesses of the Popular Front in France in the 1930s. Islamism is dominated by a middle-class leadership which suffers from the depredation of theft of its resources by the imperialists and by Israel, but is scared to finish accounts with it, because to do so would threaten its wealthy backers, the people as the main payroll supporters, businessmen and so forth, the Saudi and the Gulf states' royal families. Because a serious struggle against Israel would mean unleashing the working class, whose labour is the very foundation of their own wealth. And so, of course, that's the last thing they're going to do. And also because the leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah ultimately see themselves as a ruling class in the waiting. You know, they want to be a government. They want to take their seats in the United Nations. They want to have a seat in the World Bank and so forth, and sign deals as important national state figures. And by unleashing a social revolution in the Middle East, that would jeopardize that whole prospect. This is quite clear when you listen to some of the speeches of some of the key Islamist figures. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, was interviewed in 2000. On the question about, as you put it, whether or not the road to Palestine must pass through overthrowing Arab rulers. He was rung up on Al Jazeera by a caller, and he said, "What is your attitude to this, Hassan Nasrallah?" And Hassan says, "I told him I do not believe this to be true. If we as Arab peoples begin a battle to overthrow Arab regimes, Israel will benefit and achieve even more from these internal wars and disputes across the Arab world. What's the solution? The class alliance. What we need most is for Arab peoples to shoulder their responsibility towards Palestine by supporting the Palestinian people and by putting pressure on their governments in order for these governments to take similar stances." So again, a bit like, if you like, the kind of French case in the 1930s, the crucial unit is not the working class or class, but is, if you like, peace-loving governments, or in this case, anti-Zionist governments. And so once again puts the state and the capitalist class as the linchpin of the struggle. And these facts mean that the Islamists in the Middle East cannot be trusted to fight a no-compromises struggle against imperialism, as has been demonstrated time and again in the history of these forces. As Marx predicted, only the working class in the Middle East can resolve the issue both of the democratic revolution, freedom from national oppression, freedom of self-determination for the Palestinian people, and in the course of doing so, free itself from social and economic exploitation. So the two struggles are fused, as Trotsky argued in his theory of permanent revolution. The working class could collaborate with other social forces, but not the bourgeoisie, but areas of the middle class and so forth, and particularly in the third world and the less developed countries, the middle class and small property owning class is quite a significant proportion of the population. But the working class, as Marx argued back in 1850, has to lead. and has to put forward its own program and has to be organized independently in its own party. Only on that basis can it make overtures to other parties based on other social classes for united struggle. But bearing in mind all the time that these other forces will be tempted to draw back from the ultimate confrontation with the enemy, and that the working class's reaction to that drawing back should not be drawing back themselves, but to actually advance to the next stage. So, to sum up, I hope what I've shown in the course of this 150-year review of this question, starting in the 1840s and going through to the 2000s, that the essential arguments made by Marx in his March address of 1850 still ring true today. The working class is the only force that has both the interest and the capacity to fight both to complete the democratic revolution, which is a task facing the European working class in the 1840s, and also end exploitation of working class and peasants themselves. Now, these struggles have to be brought together as part of the one and the same struggle. The bourgeoisie of some countries, even if it suffers from imperialist oppression, and clearly the Palestinian bourgeoisie does suffer from imperialist oppression, but just by the same extent did the European bourgeoisie suffer from the old feudal order of the 1840s. The bourgeoisie is not a reliable ally, because they are tied together in Egypt in 2007, as much as in Austria and Italy in 1848. The bourgeoisie is tied by 1,001 threads, in the modern Middle Eastern case, to the imperialists, just as they were tied as 1,001 threads to the old feudal order in 1848. And they fear the kind of mass struggle that can bring about even the democratic outcome of a struggle against imperialism. This doesn't mean, however, that the working class cannot enter into alliance with other social forces, but in order to do so, it has to retain its organisational and political independence. It has to position itself as a leading force and not be dragged into opportunist compromises with its allies for the sake of keeping everyone together, and has to be on guard against the constant tendency of the middle classes to vacillate, to draw back from the ultimate struggle. Only in this way can we see the aggregation of forces actually lead to an enhancement and the strengthening of the struggle, not its frustration and abandonment, as has been the case with the class alliance strategy now for 150 years.